The 36th annual Cathedral Park Jazz Festival is almost here, and KABU will once again be carrying it live Saturday, July 16. The fun begins Friday night with blues artists such as Ken Emerson and Sister Mercy. Saturday and Sunday will deliver some of Portland's finest: Dan Bomber, Highwater Jazz Band, Joe Manis, Eric Lewis, Tim Wilcox, Mel Brown, Farnell Newton, and more. That's July 15th, 16th, and 17th under the St. John's Bridge at Cathedral Park, the longest-running music festival in Portland, brought to you by the Jazz Society of Oregon and KABU. Full details at cpjazz.com.
Tune in to KABU for our 25-hour fundraising extravaganza of special programming and community celebration. Tune in at 8 a.m. for Voices from the Edge with Joanne Hardesty. Her guest will be retired Seattle City Council member Nick Licata, author of the new book, Becoming a Citizen Activist: Stories, Strategies, and Advice for Changing Our World. Again, that's 6 a.m. on July 14th through 7 a.m. on July 15th to support your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
I wish I was a mole in the ground. Yes, I wish I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down. And I wish I was a mole in the ground.
Good morning. You are tuned to KBOO in Portland, where the time is now 9:01, and time for the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm your host, Clayton Morgeridge. Our engineer is Patsy Kullberg. We call ourselves moles because we work underground to explore the hidden roots of the social order we live in, of which the mass media shows us only the glossy, manufactured surfaces, obscuring the machinery of deception and exploitation which keeps us enslaved to an unjust world order. The old mole signifies the revolution that works unnoticed underground and pops up in world affairs at unexpected moments to set history on a radically new course. The Old Mole Collective works hard every week to bring you the best radical analysis available on the air anywhere. If you like what you hear, you can hear it again or recommend it to your friends by searching for the Old Mole Variety Hour on the KBOO website. That's kboo.fm. You can also like us on Facebook to get regular updates and follow us on Twitter. On today's show, Bill Resnick will be talking with author Sharon Casimir about the Mondragon worker-owned cooperatives in the Basque region of Spain and whether they are a model pointing the way beyond capitalism. Then we will hear voices from the Quinault Indian Nation's march and rally this past Saturday in resistance to the proposed expansion of an existing oil terminal in Grays Harbor. Finally, Jan Hocken will be talking with the director of a film, Loose Horses, that will be shown as part of the Farm Edition series at the Northwest Film Center next week. First up, though, because of the terrible events of last week in Minneapolis, Baton Rouge, and Dallas, I want to share with you some of the commentary that has seemed most helpful from commentators on the left. After five policemen were killed in Dallas on Saturday, Attorney General Loretta Lynch called for a national conversation. She said, "We must continue working to build trust between communities and law enforcement. We must continue working to guarantee every person in this country equal justice under the law. We must take a hard look at the ease with which wrongdoers can get their hands on deadly weapons and the frequency with which they use them. We must reject the easy impulses of bitterness and rancor and embrace the difficult task of working, of finding a path forward together." End quote. But there is a fundamental problem with the suggestion, according to Kevin Gastola, writing on Shadowproof. As Center for Constitutional Rights Director Vincent Warren has said, "To present the situation as mutual distrust not only obscures the specific causes of that distrust, it intimates that everyone is equally responsible for the problem. The call for conversation as the solution then reinforces this idea that the legitimate problems with law enforcement vocalized by minority communities are really all just one big misunderstanding, Warren added. Our political leaders should not begin to offer solutions for a problem if they won't even name it. Systemic institutional racism exists in police forces throughout our country. End of quote. Now, notice that there is nothing in Lynch's statement about holding police officers accountable. There is nothing about stepping up action against police who get their hands on deadly weapons and the frequency with which they use them. Like the blowback against American superpower, which brought about the September 11th attacks, there will continue to be blowback against police so long as officers and departments throughout the country keep engaging in horrific acts of violence and oppression against minority communities. And that's the end of that quote. Attorney General Lynch and many others speak of what we as a nation or as a society must do, assuming that there is a we for our discourse to address, a we that could conceivably think and act together to make things better. Several writers suggest that the we is broken up, that there is no coherent body politic, no social contract we have implicitly agreed to live by. The complicated hegemony that holds us together is constituted now more by force, alienation, and fear than by freely given consent. Along these lines, Henry Giroux writes that the U.S. is deep into the entrails of an updated authoritarianism in which citizenship is emptied of its content. The right to be represented is ceded to the financial elite and the institutions of repression. Under such circumstances, politics is replaced by a form of anti-politics in which the representative and repressive machineries of the state combine to objectify, dehumanize, and humiliate through racial profiling, eliminate crucial social provisions, transform poor black neighborhoods into war zones, militarize the police, undermine the system of justice, and all too willingly use violence both to punish blacks and to signal them that any form of dissent can cost them their lives, end of quote. Even Giroux invokes an implicit we who might recognize this authoritarianism and somehow act to reverse it. One familiar way in which the we are divided is described by Andrew O'Hare, writing on Salon.com. No doubt it's overstating the case to say that America has a white reality and a black reality, which are mutually contradictory and rarely overlap, but it's not overstating by much. Most whites perceive law enforcement as even-handed and fair-minded and believe the unnecessary use of lethal force is a rare and unfortunate event. Law-abiding citizens of whatever color have nothing to fear from the cops. But African Americans of almost any class or economic background are alert to a long history of official racism and police brutality that may have altered its form and terminology, but keeps recurring year after year in dozens or hundreds of cases that end with black bodies dead in the street, end of quote. It may be, though, that some white, even conservative Americans are beginning to appreciate what a different world black Americans live in. But O'Hare describes another familiar divide. As we can see from the reactions to this week's dreadful events on the competing news channels and social media, we have a liberal reality and a conservative reality. In the conservative version, the greatest nation in the world, that would be the USA, has come under sustained attack both at home and abroad. The nation's enemies are big government socialists, the identity politics thought police, Black Lives Matter, feminists and gays, and Spanish-speaking immigrants and radical Islam, and Barack Hussein Obama. All these share a common agenda and are quite likely working together. In the other liberal version of reality, evil corporations and embittered white racists have forged a nightmare coalition devoted to rolling back every progressive reform of the last 80 years and turning 21st century America into a Doctor Who-style mashup of Victorian England, Leave It to Beaver, and The Handmaid's Tale. End of quote. And finally, there is the issue of the extent of policing. Writing in The Nation, Kai Wright points to a simple fact about law enforcement. There is too much of it, touching too many aspects of daily life, creating too many opportunities for it to inflict violence upon the public it is supposed to serve. This has always been true for black people in one way or another. From the 1793 Fugitive Slave Act forward, public safety officers have been empowered to harass black bodies in the defense of private capital and the pursuit of public revenue. As a result, no generation of black Americans has been spared the macabre tradition of drilling into its children tips for avoiding death at the hands of the state. Law enforcement agencies are among the largest and most powerful bureaucracies in most localities, and they are deeply enmeshed in our daily lives, particularly in communities of color. They are our first responders. They are in our schools. They are our immigration officials. For the most vulnerable among us, they are often what passes for social workers and mental health care providers, and they are armed. At some point, we must question whether all of this law enforcement is necessary and whether public safety is best served by having much, much less of it. End of quote. Well, there's that we again. But surely it is the task of the left to build the community that can be this we, capable of asking these hard questions and acting accordingly. Next up on The Old Mole, first we'll have some music.
I am saying that there's no way to delay that trouble coming every day. No way to delay that trouble coming every day. Hey, you know something, people? I'm not black, but there's a whole lot of times I wish I could say I'm not white. Well, I've seen the fires burning and the local people turning on the merchants and the shops who used to sell their brooms and mops and every other household item. Watch a mob just turn and bite them, and they say it served them right because a few of them were white. And it's the same across the nation, black and white discrimination. Yeah, and you can't understand me and all that other jazz they hand me in the papers and TV and all that mass stupidity that seems to grow more every day. These time you hear something would say, he wants to go and do you in, cause the color of your skin just don't appeal to him, no matter if it's black or white, because he's out for blood tonight.
And that's from Frank Zappa's song Trouble Every Day here on the Old Mole Variety Hour, following up on some voices from the left about the shootings last week. Well, the Mondragon co-ops in Spain have seemed to many on the left to demonstrate a successful and very different economic model, a cooperative model that broke down the hierarchy and inequality of late capitalism, a model that we egalitarian, the model that is egalitarian and democratic. But the reality has fallen short of the dream. Here is the Old Mole's Bill Resnick to talk with Sharon Kazmir, who has written a book about Mondragon.
Sharon Kazmir, welcome to KABU.
Thank you. I'm glad to be with you.
Sharon Kazmir teaches, chairs the Department of Anthropology at Hofstra University. She authored the book, The Myth of Mondragon, Cooperatives, Politics, and Working Class Life in a Basque Town. So Sharon Kazmir, Mondragon is becoming Mecca for the left, was seen as demonstrating a very successful, very different economic model, a cooperative model that broke down the hierarchy and inequalities of late capitalism, a model that was egalitarian and democratic. But if at the beginning it showed a lot of great promise, the reality fell short of the dream that many on the left propagated, especially recently. Sharon Kazmir, tell us why you came to study Mondragon in the late 1980s and early 90s. Then we can get into your findings and the findings of others and conclude with what Mondragon can teach us about worker cooperatives, how to have the best chance that they will be stably democratic and still survive in a capitalist economy. So, Sharon, what attracted you to Mondragon to study it?
Well, I first learned about Mondragon as an undergraduate student at the University of Massachusetts. I think a lot of people get their first introduction to Mondragon in an early class like that. In my class, where I learned about Mondragon was on an anthropology class on egalitarian societies. So we learned about the cooperative model in the context of other and longer-term expressions of egalitarian and democratic relations within human societies. So what's important for me, my questions going in about the cooperatives were really rooted in this anthropological sense that humans are very capable of being egalitarian and democratic and non-hierarchical, and that different ways of organizing societies enabled those capacities. They might have particular sets of problems or challenges, but that we were, as a species, you know, clearly capable of this kind of set of human and social relations. So that was my kind of more philosophical set of interests going into Mondragon. But I went there specifically to do my dissertation research. My first trip was in 1987, and then I returned in 1989 and 90 for about a year and a half of intensive ethnographic field work in the town of Mondragon and also in a Fagor. At the time, it became part of Fagor Electrodomesticos, the big group of domestic appliances, but at the time was an individual Fagor factory that produced washing machines. And I compared that factory with a local, non-cooperative, but unionized washing machine factory to really see what the differences were for workers of being in a cooperative versus being in a unionized firm. My introduction to this city came very close to the ground. And what I mean by that is, you know, even before I made my way into my many meetings with Mondragon management and the bureaucracy, I met workers in town. And my first encounter with, you know, working class folks, I was in my mid-20s, folks of my own age who were working in the cooperatives either as, you know, relatively new members or as temporary workers. My first introduction was really through their perspective, and they were not animated and enthused and committed to the workplace as an alternative form of work organization. They felt alienated in their jobs. They felt supervised by, if they were temporary workers, they felt supervised and scrutinized by the members. They felt that the work was, you know, very regimented and very stressful. So there was no real sense that working in a cooperative had a meaningful difference in their work lives. And as I had further conversations with them, there was all similarly no real sense that the democratic participation that was available to them through the social councils and the general assemblies of the cooperatives made a meaningful difference either. And so very early on, I came upon this clear sense that what was missing from the very robust dialogue on the Mondragon cooperatives, and the Mondragon cooperatives is a model for egalitarianism or a model for the left or an anti-capitalist model, what was clearly missing was a working class perspective. And it struck me as quite odd and counterintuitive that people from the left would go to look at an industrial system and not want to really focus on what workers were experiencing in that system. The literature really took the word of management and took the word of the people who were charged with communicating with outside people through seminars or organized trips, took the word of those people as the kind of perspective of the group, as what was really going on. Yeah.
Sharon, you were talking, though, to the non-members. When co-ops begin hiring other labor under different conditions, and non-members means they weren't voting, they weren't asked to participate, and they were being pushed hard to, as in fact workers were pushing themselves, the members were pushing themselves because this big washing machine plant, they're in hot competition with many other firms, and in fact not distinguishing themselves as more profitable. What about the members? How did they feel about it?
I was talking to both temporary workers and members on a regular basis. And what I learned from members was similarly the case that their work lives were not substantially different from the capitalist firm down the street, nor was their involvement in democratic decision-making empowering in a way that was robust. And when I compared their participation in the cooperative democratic organs with the ways that unionized members were able to take power over the shop floor through their union and through standard union procedures, I found that the co-op workers, in fact, had less real power on the shop floor in meaningful ways in daily life.
Of course, the Spanish unions were, at that time, especially in Basque country, that had this great traditions of community empowerment, of worker fight back. The Franco regime, the Spanish dictatorship, was particularly murderous towards the Basque country and Basque workers and the people of Barcelona and the countryside. I mean, they really had powerful unions and traditions of asserting power. This is Bill Resnick for The Old Mole. I'm talking to Sharon Casimir, who's studied Mondragon, the great experiment in worker cooperatives, so important to the left as proving that they do work. What Sharon found, this is though the late 80s and 90s, is that workers in cooperative production in Mondragon were, in many of the cases, less involved in their work and less participatory and felt they had less power on the shop floor than in unionized plants in Mondragon. Sharon Casimir, how is this being explained, and what's your explanation?
Well, my explanation really stemmed from looking at the working class as a whole in the region and in Mondragon, as the city of Mondragon in particular. And what I saw, and the lesson I thought was not being taught from Mondragon, there are lots of positive lessons from Mondragon, and I think we should talk about those. But one sort of real warning was that co-ops very early on began to fragment and divide the local working class, such that cooperative members really kind of took themselves out of the broad-based working class movement and then the labor movement that had been so important under Franco and had been so important in the development of a left and a socialist project for the Basque Country. And you had said before, and you're quite right, that it was a really robust socialist and radical labor movement, but what was missing was the co-op workers. And as early as the 1970s, you get some critiques from the left, from the Basque left, about this fact. The cooperative workers are not solidaric. They are, you know, an aristocracy of labor in our midst. And that kind of developed throughout. The other thing is that there are no internal strikes allowed in the cooperatives. So that means you don't get the development of a political cohort and a group of leaders the way you do in a factory where you have union agitation, labor struggle, strikes, you know, conflict. And so you really had a lack of a cohort that could lead an alternative working class vision within the co-ops. And so what I saw is that a kind of managerial perspective, which quickly became a kind of bureaucratic, we have to compete, we have to do everything possible to compete, competition is the most important thing, that discourse and that perspective took over without workers' ability to effectively confront it with any kind of alternative plan or strategy for the future of the co-ops.
Yeah, of course, the workers have been unable to come up with an alternative plan or strategy for quite a long time as capital became more mobile over greater distances. But it was still very mobile in the late 80s and 90s. Instead of moving to China, they were moving to Mexico or moving to the American South, prospecting for cheaper labor, however they could get it. And workers were situated in factories and communities and couldn't move and didn't want to. That's partly the reason that wages for manufacturing workers, particularly those considered unskilled, Mondragon and Fager, were under tremendous pressure, financial pressure, in order to maintain relatively high wages and decent conditions in their factories in Spain.
This is true. So what they've done quite effectively up until recently, there really hasn't been a bankruptcy in a and a kind of flight of capital out of the Basque region. So anybody who looks at Mondragon, even me, who I'm a critic, I see very clearly that they've been very good at wedding capital to place. So workers in the Basque country, members in the Basque country, retained their jobs. But they did that at the expense, and this goes back to the issue of fragmentation, but now we'll talk at a global scale. They did that at the expense of employing wage laborers in subsidiaries throughout the world. I think there's something like 100 foreign subsidiaries at this point in Mondragon. And the workers in those subsidiaries are working at wage rates that are equivalent of their developing or post-Soviet bloc wages, and they're exploited at the rates that all international capitalists exploit workers. And there's some very good research out of the University of the Basque Country, Bilbao, by economists that look at these subsidiaries and show that the conditions in the Mondragon-owned subsidiaries are really no different than any capitalist firm. So yes, they've contained work in the Basque Country. The cooperatives have successfully contained work in the Basque Country. But if we're talking about these enterprises, not just as capitalist businesses that may or may not be better for workers, but as models of socialism, we don't want to build models of socialism based on a global division of workers where some benefit at the expense of others. That's nobody's vision of socialism. It reminds me of a really powerful quote by W.E.B. Du Bois. He's looking at race riots in East St. Louis and a mass slaughter of black workers by white workers, and he says, socialism for whom? So we want to be careful to create models of socialism that create sort of egalitarian relations across what might otherwise have been divisions and inequalities among workers. And that's kind of the heart of where the Mondragon model doesn't serve us well.
This is KBOO Radio, Portland, Oregon. Bill Resnick here talking to Sharon Kazmir, who wrote the book, The Myth of Mondragon, Cooperatives, Politics, and Working Class Life in a Basque Town. Sharon, earlier in the interview, you said there's lots of things in Mondragon that we can be proud of and learn from and that move in the right direction. You also pointed out that within the longstanding economic crisis of the West and the huge pressure on industrial workers, particularly from competition when capital got completely mobile, from people earning 1/10, 1/20 of their wage in mass production plants, that Mondragon moved in really completely the wrong direction. That is, by outsourcing, by putting up factories in China and particularly the Eastern Bloc, the former Soviet satellites, where workers were ready to work for very little. What was good about Mondragon? What can we still look to? In fact, they recognized that they fell into bad patterns and were trying to get out of it and were trying to escape that. And what does it teach us about how to structure cooperatives, to structure them so that they operate as global workers rather than just fighting for their local jobs however they can?
I think that's the right question. There are a lot of good things about Mondragon, and criticism aside, we want to look at most notably the idea that you can create some community control over capital, right? So that's an important dimension of this, that the property ownership in the hands of the workers creates a level of community control over capital. We want to broaden that community and make it less exclusive, but we want to sort of think about how to structure that in ways that are meaningful. The other thing is the Mondragon is well known for having a very minimal pay differential between the lowest paid worker and the highest paid manager. It's capped at 1 to 9, and in many of the cooperatives, it doesn't even reach that. And it shows us that we can produce efficiently without very highly paid managers or CEOs. And that's a very, very important lesson. I think you're right that there's a recognition that the subsidiary model creates contradictions that have to be addressed. And so there are some efforts to kind of globalize some of the learning, democratic learning structures of the cooperatives, really kind of spread a culture of cooperative democracy. And I'm not sure that there are real successes yet to point to, but the initiatives are interesting and important. And the kind of global support for social economy initiatives that Mondragon represents are quite an important feature of the system. So those are some of the real main contributions that Mondragon gives to the international left. It's also a tricky thing because I think we want to teach our students and young people that there's a model out there that works. And I want to do that too, but I want to do that without suggesting that the only thing we look at is our own workers and their well-being in our one little place. And that's the kind of contradiction that you pointed to. So what I try to emphasize when I talk about this is that cooperatives, yes, but within a larger political and social movement, and that we can't neglect the movement piece of this. And the role that cooperatives play gets determined by the nature of the larger movement and its connections and alliances with that larger movement. There's a really interesting article in Jacobin magazine in March by Sam Gindin that really lays out some of these larger political questions for cooperatives that I think is very articulate and useful on this topic. We can't look at cooperatives as the path to socialism. They may play a part in a larger social movement, but they're not going to get us to socialism within a capitalist economic system. If there's a single lesson from the Mondragon cooperatives, is that you really just can't build socialism and engage in capitalist competition. The contradictions are too great. And what we see happening is that it can benefit some workers, but it can't create broad-based egalitarian relations.
Sharon Kasmer, thanks a lot for talking to us. One final thing, though. You mentioned Sam Gindin's article in Jacobin. I also want to suggest your article in the New Labor Forum, The Mondragon Cooperatives and Global Capitalism, a Critical Analysis, on page 52 of the New Labor Forum for winter 2016. We'll put those links up on our when we archive this interview. Sharon Kasmer, thanks so much for talking to us.
Thanks, Bill.
Right, so long. Keep up the good work.
Thank you, Bill. This is the Old Mole Variety Hour here on KBOO in Portland. I'm your host, Clayton Morgridge. Next up, here is our field mole, Desiree Helligers, with voices from the Quinault Indian Nation's Shared Waters, Shared Values March and Rally from this past Saturday. The event brought together a native canoe flotilla and non-native kayaktivists in a show of resistance to the proposed expansion of an existing oil terminal in Grays Harbor.
This past Friday, July 8th, the Quinault Indian Nation hosted an intertribal canoe and fishing boat flotilla and water blessing as part of a broader campaign of resistance against the proposed expansion of the existing Westway oil terminal in Grays Harbor. A kayak flotilla of non-native allies was on hand by invitation of the Quinault tribe to accompany the tribal flotilla. As the tribal canoes took to the water, non-native kayaktivists, with logistical support from the Vashon Island-based Backbone Campaign and the Mosquito Fleet, talked through the logistics for the day's events.
Hi, Graham, I'm with Mosquito Fleet. We'll have some safeties in the water. We'll have one at the front, two on the sides, one in the rear. We're going to have that boat down there that's the keel that has a stand-up the oil train. Flyers inside that's actually floating in the water. That'll be our medical boat for the day. We'll be in the rear at all times unless there's an emergency. Coastal Sailors canoes are almost all, they're all in the water and they're all getting in their boats. So,
yeah, so if
you don't want to make them wait.
Yeah.
Time for us to do it.
As the tribal canoes and fishing boats docked in downtown Hoquiam, kayaktivists, still on the water, worked to raise a banner that read, Shared Waters, Shared Values, in keeping with the theme of the day set by the Quinault Nation.
Okay, we're supposed to keep the rope in front of us.
Okay, keep going.
More, we need to move it one more over.
Which way?
This way. Left.
Ready?
Is all the banner all the way rolled out?
Yeah.
Yep.
Okay.
That doesn't need to go over.
Not ready yet.
Okay.
Okay. And give people the brakes. Your brakes
are on the brakes. Heat seat
here. You need to grab your wrist.
Try to pull the back of your paddles together.
Okay.
Try to pull the backs of the kayaks together.
Yeah.
We got it. Hang on to it.
After we docked, I spoke with Quinault fisherman Junior Goodell.
Shared.
shared water, shared values message. I mean, that's really what I find the most interesting about this, and the most most gratifying, the shared values. Like right here, we have a tribal fishing boat. Right across the way, we have a recreational fishing boat. So it's been very, very good to see, you know, the non-tribal and the tribal communities really come together for one cause. You know, here to march on City Hall and tell our leadership that, you know, oil is it's very risky and the risk is very serious to our future and our water and our natural resources.
The rally in front of Hoquiam City Hall was led by Fawn Sharp, who is serving her fourth term as the president of the Quinault Indian Nation and is also vice president of the National Congress of American Indians.
Who stands against oil?
All right.
On behalf of the Quinault Indian Nation, I first of all want to take the opportunity to thank everyone for being here. We anticipated 400 to 600, and I think we have a little more than that. So let's give everyone a round of applause. We honor all lives. Every life is precious. That's one of our values. Not only the life of the average human being, the life of all things natural, all animals, all plants, all life. The Creator intended us to be stewards of our land, intended us to have mutual respect, to respect our values in each other. As you can see from those standing, we've got the mayor of Hoquiam. Let's recognize her and give her a round of applause for joining us. Yay! Tribal nations with us. The Lummi. We have the Quileutes joining us. And we have the Macaw joining us. This last year we saw tribal unity and tribal strength take down Cherry Point. And we see it across the country, not only are tribal citizens taking a stand, but those non-Indian citizens that share our values and share our waters. You've stood strong with us, and we thank you for that, too. Now, we're at a critical place here in Grace Harbor. A decision is going to be made soon. The future of this harbor is going to go in one direction or the other. We need it to go in the direction of no crude oil in Grace Harbor. When you think about what's at stake at Quinault, you know, we commissioned an economic study. And about 10,000 jobs are at risk and being jeopardized. 700 tribal fishermen. Do we have our fishermen here? And about 3,200 non-tribal fishermen. Do we have non-tribal fishermen here? And about 4,000 jobs that are tourism-related and tourism-based. Who all here supports tourism in Grace Harbor? Industries compromised, but the general health and welfare of all citizens would be compromised by this decision. You know, our ancestors gave up so much in signing the treaties. They wanted to ensure that our generation, and we are the seventh generation since the Quinault Treaty was signed in the 1800s. This generation is the generation that was secured by treaty. And it's this generation that is going to stand on our treaty to ensure seven generations in the future. Junior at one point said the salmon deserve to be in healthy systems, healthy waters. They cannot get out of the water and fight for themselves. It's up to us to take a stand for that precious salmon and that precious resource. So we are the voice not only of future generations of our citizens, we are the voice of future generations of an abundance of salmon that we want to ensure will always remain in Grace Harbor. No oil company, domestic or foreign, will ever be in a position to compromise and destroy that resource that God the Creator intended for us to enjoy, for us to protect, and for us to long stand by. Yeah! When we think about our future generations and our young children, they have so much to learn and to honor and to respect. And when they see the average citizen, the average adult take the stand that we take today, we're teaching them something very valuable.
Yes.
And we want to ensure that we continue to teach those future generations the values. As I said, when we came in, not only are we sharing the waters and sharing the values today, but we are honoring our ancestors. Ooh. We are honoring those ancestors that from the beginning of time paddled and fished in these waters. I'm happy to yield the floor and yield the microphone to Nicholas Lewis, representing the Lummi Indian Business Council. Lewis.
We're truly proud to be here and stand with you guys. Now, in Lummi, that recently we had our own fight against the coal terminal at Cherry Point. Because of allies and people that supported us, like the Quinaults, the Quileutes, and the cause, non-tribals as well, the environmental, everybody stood with us. And because of that, we were able to beat the coal industry and say, not in our home. And that's exactly what we're going to do. People are not going to sell our soul for that dirty dollar any longer. And it's time that we stand together like we are today and in the future, because the threat's not ever going to be over. As long as these people have corporate interests to pat in their pockets and destroy the environment, they're going to be attacking any way they can. And it's because of all of you that we're here today that we can say no more. You guys will not get away with it, not in our home, not in our community. As Juan said, we're going to be here. You know, we have seven generations we're looking out for. That seven generations is going to come up, and they're going to be looking out for the next seven generations. We've been doing this since time immemorial. We were born here, and we're going to die here. And we want to leave it as beautiful for our kids as it was for our ancestors that left it to us all.
Thank you.
And thank you for
the next speaker, I'd like to introduce Larry Thievick. No! Larry is the vice president of the Washington Dungeness Crab Fishermen's Association. And I'm very happy to say that, you know, when Quinault stood about 3 years ago, close to 4 years ago, Larry was an early and strong ally of ours. Back then, we could foretell the tragedy that would unfold over the course of the next 4 years with oil terrain derailments. And we had a strategy session on our very first meetings at the Quinault Nation, and we invited folks, and Larry happily accepted the invitation way back then and has stood strong with us from day one ever since.
According to the University of Washington report, marine resource dependent jobs account for 30 to 35% of Grays Harbor and Pacific County's workforce.
Wow.
A Port of Grays Harbor study states approximately 2,300 jobs and $230 million annually come from just fishing activity in Westport. As everyone knows, Grays Harbor needs more jobs, but our members have concluded that the benefits from the terminals simply do not measure up to the risks that they bear. Not that many, yet the potential threat to existing jobs is huge.
Yes.
Grays Harbor is the fourth largest estuary in the nation. Wow. It is a major nursery area for Dungeness crab. It is an essential fishing habitat for many other species. According to the Department of Fish and Wildlife, Grays Harbor is an area that is particularly sensitive to the adverse effects of oil spills. If there were to be a spill, the volume of oil that's being considered would lead to a catastrophic loss of habitat. And the potentially affected area would be much larger than the Grays Harbor vicinity. Remember, the Exxon Valdez spilled 11 million gallons and it damaged 1,300 miles of coastline. The Nestucca oil barge that was hauled off of Grays Harbor spilled only 231,000 gallons, and that spill killed 56,000 seabirds, and a sheen was seen from Oregon to the north tip of Vancouver Island. The tankers that will move through Grays Harbor will haul up to 15 million gallons.
Leaving the rally, I spoke with Zarna Joshi, an organizer with the Seattle-based grassroots environmental justice group, Women of Color Speak Out.
Here representing Women of Color Speak Out. And what we stand for is we stand for climate justice and we stand in solidarity with Indigenous peoples and the peoples of the Global South. So because this was a Quinault Nation-led action, and because the Quinault Nation was working with the Quaaludes and the Macaws and so many other tribes, and within the Coast Salish people's territory, we are in solidarity with them and we absolutely stand with them. And we stand here to say no more oil. We are going to stop the fossil fuel empire. We are going to dismantle it and we are going to build a future that our children deserve.
For more information on how you can join Out of Grays Harbor, see the Quinault Indian Nation website or the website for the Friends of Grays Harbor. This coming week, the City of Aberdeen will be voting on a proposed ban on crude oil storage and handling for the City of Aberdeen. Also, on July 18th, the City of Vancouver at 7 p.m. will be holding a public hearing and likely a vote also on a proposed ban that would bar the crude oil storage, handling, and refining in the City of Vancouver. For more information on that upcoming hearing in Vancouver, see the website for the Columbia Riverkeeper. That's columbiariverkeeper.org. This has been Desiree Helgers for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
Yes, that was Desiree Helgers with voices from the Quinault Indian Nation at their march and rally and flotilla last Saturday against the expansion of an oil terminal in Grays Harbor. You're tuned to KBOO in Portland and the Old Mole Variety Hour. Well, starting a week from tonight, January 18th, at the Northwest Film Center at the Portland Art Museum, is a very interesting film series about farming and animal husbandry in the Northwest. One of the films is by the Old Mole's Jan Hocken. It's called Milkmen, and it's about the challenges dairies are facing as they are forced to increase production to keep up with the forces in the global economy. That film will be shown on Monday at 7 in the Witzel Auditorium. Now, Jan is actually with us this morning on the Old Mole to interview the director of another film on the same program, Kathy Kosick, whose film Loose Horses will be shown on Tuesday evening. Here's Jan.
Kathy Kosick, welcome to KBOO.
Thank you very much. It's good to be on here.
Well, and we look forward to seeing you soon here in the City of Roses. Let's start by talking a little about your film and its intriguing title, Loose Horses. Just tell us a little of what it's about.
Well, it's a Verite documentary about unwanted horses at a livestock auction. It takes place in Billings, Montana, which is actually one of the largest livestock auctions in the U.S., and they often hold auctions for unwanted horses here, which they call loose horses. And so people drop off their unwanted horses, and these are working ranch horses, show horses, pets, breeding horses, things like that. And the owners hope that their horses will get picked up by someone and given a good home. But this is kind of a spoiler. It sort of gets released through the film. Often the horses are bought by meat buyers for the horse meat industry and sold across the world for food. So we are told this story in part by a kind of gruff cowboy named Buzz, who follows one horse through the auction.
Yeah, and Buzz is an unlikely protagonist for a film of this sort, which has, I think, offers somewhat of a critique, though we can perhaps talk about that further, how your film and the films in this series are carry kind of critical ideas. But the Buzz character, this kind of crusty cowboy, is not a subject you would expect to have sympathies for, but the film really relies heavily on him as a kind of moral vantage point or to provide moral perspective or insights on all these people who come to the auction barn to get rid of their horses. How do you think of that character who really becomes more interesting and complex as the film unfolds? How do you place him in your project?
Yeah, so he is an unlikely character. You would think, you know, he's a sort of a gruff cowboy, and he kind of comes across as very tough. But he has a very warm heart, especially for horses, probably more so than he does for the people who drop them off. And I think in that way, he sort of becomes the person who speaks for the horses, right? And he's allowing us to sort of see this very complicated issue from their perspective. And so that was really why we chose him, because he has such a unique perspective on these animals. And he actually has kind of like his own horse facility where he takes care of horses, but it's sort of right by the auction and maybe not what you would expect.
And you make very effective use, I think, of the auction barn as a site for, and almost a microcosm, we might say, for larger social forces that, as people come and go and offer various reasons and rationalizations for why they're leaving their horses there to be killed or perhaps sold. Maybe you could do a similar thing with and places where people take their pets to be quote put to sleep, but
right.
Stray pets. But how do you think about the, you know, when you say the perspective of the horses, but of course the perspectives of domesticated animals are always framed through the interests of their owners or human interests and their well-being or their productive value. How do you think about the kind of moral or political or ethical aspects of what's going on in this auction barn?
Yeah, well, I think that, I really like how you describe this thing called moral ambiguity, I think is what you call it, which I think your film touches on quite a lot. And, I think just wanted to say that I'm very excited to see your film again, because I think that we have such a unique connection between the two, even though they're about different things. This idea of moral ambiguity, I think, is a vein that runs through both of them. But if I can sort of say what you were meaning by it, quite often morality is sort of black and white, right, where it's very easy to see the good and the bad, whereas when sometimes much of what we deal with in our culture is quite complex and has many sides to it, and even between cultures we can think of morality quite differently. And so I think that's where this issue of moral ambiguity comes in. And
often, perhaps pointedly, in our relationship with animals, what animals were permitted to eat, or the boundary. Mary Douglas,
right.
The social anthropologist, described this distinction in many cultures between clean and unclean, including clean and unclean animals, and what we can eat and can't eat, and how this carries a lot of other symbolic loadings in a culture.
That's right. And I think this livestock auction allows us to kind of to see all of this from one place. And so we are immersed in the place where it all happens. You know, the crux of the moment for these horses is, will they get picked up by somebody or will they be sent off to the horse meat industry, where things get very complicated very quickly. They have long journeys to go to the slaughterhouse. They then get sold across the world for food, you know, sometimes for, you know, fancier food than others, but sometimes just for nourishment. And I think what you can then see is something that reveals itself to be quite a lot more complex than what we might originally think about the issue of horse meat.
Both of us, I think, confronted interesting dynamics, my going into dairy farms and you're into these auction barns, where ranchers or farmers had really strong reactions to PETA, the People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, and we carried that. You know, we were, I'm sure, both profiled right on the spot, liberals,
right,
from
not
the
exactly
city.
Cowgirl.
Yeah, right. And having to, and my own view is to not distance myself or diss that group. because they have raised important critical issues, but I also think they have perpetuated some stereotypes of rural people. If you see a lot of their online videos, you see primarily Hispanic workers brutally beating animals as though it's an everyday occurrence. And so the critique there gets lost in this highly dramatic, distorted imagery. On the other hand, farmers and ranchers have their own crude stereotypes of animal rights activists. How did you deal with, so to speak, walking that fence?
I think that that was a very tricky line. And I do have to say I owe a lot to the producer of the film, Barb Marshall, because she has a farm, and she kind of walks that line a little better than me. And I think that, you know, for us, it was a challenge because we did get kicked out at one point because they were worried that we were more representing the interests of PETA. And we said, no, we're actually trying to tell the whole story rather than just one side of it. So, and then at that point, they started to trust us. And then a couple of years later, it took a while, but we gained more trust. And then they sort of allowed us to come into the option and really film it and really be able to talk to people that normally we wouldn't be able to. And I think so by approaching it in that way where it's not an advocacy film, I think then you're allowed to see things from a deeper perspective.
And that's perhaps a topic for another day, how you bring political commitments so we're not simply these neutral observers, objective in any meaningful sense, but have critical ideas, but also bring a respect and set of commitments to the participants in films who bring enormous trust inevitably to how they're going to be represented. Just in closing, let's just briefly talk about what else is happening during this series. There are three films, including I want to just put out a word for Boone by Christopher LaMarca and Katrina Taylor on that follows three farmers as they traverse the hardships and inherent beauties of life and death on a small goat farm in Southern Oregon. That'll be on Wednesday evening. On Tuesday evening, before your film, and I believe Barb Marshall will be here as well. Is that right, the producer?
Yes, that's correct.
Yeah, that's fabulous. There'll be a panel beforehand that will include the filmmakers, but also Fran Michel, chair of film studies at Willamette University, and some activists around the small farm movement. So that'll be very interesting right before the screening of your film. And then Milkmen with some other crew there on Monday evening, a reception ahead of time that's open to the public at 6. So I look forward to your coming to Oregon, coming to Portland, and being part of our fabulous activist film community here.
That's great. I'm very much looking forward to it.
Yeah, me too. And we look forward to seeing you next week and the film. This is Jan Hawken talking today with Kathy Kasich, director of Loose Horses, that will be playing at the Witzel Auditorium, Northwest Film Center, on Tuesday evening, July 19th. Thanks so much for being with us today.
Thanks, Jan.
Thanks a lot, Jan and Kathy. And that concludes the Old Mole Variety Hour for today. If there's any part of this show you would like to hear again, search for the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO's website, that's kbo.fm, and you'll find links to this show and many others. Today's show will be available in a day or two. Check us out on Facebook and Twitter for announcements of upcoming shows and links to those that have been posted. I'm Clayton Morgridge. Our engineer today is Patsy Kullberg. Thanks to Bill Resnick and Sharon Kazmir for their discussion of Mondragon, to Desiree Helligers for her field recordings from the Quinault Nation's protests, and to Jan Hawken and Kathy Kasich for letting us know about some great local filmmaking. Tune in again next week for more news, views, reviews, and interviews from the Old Mole's underground perspective. And stay tuned to KBOO. At 10 o'clock, it's Air Cascadia, locally produced news, views, interviews, headlines, and commentary with Chris Andre. At 10:15, it's Locus Focus with our host, Barbara Bernstein. Today's guest is Rob Justice, founder of the homeless advocacy group, JOIN. We'll talk about the current housing crisis in Portland. At 11, we'll hear Health Watch with host Ellen Goldsmith. Today's guest is Caverly Morgan, founder of Peace in Schools, our nation's first mindfulness program for teens in Portland public high schools. And at 11:30, we'll hear Health and Healthcare Forum with host Roberta Hall. Today's guest is Janice Stanger, author of the new book, The Perfect Formula Diet, about a diet based on whole food, on whole plant foods.
Listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO at the Clinton is our monthly film series at the Clinton Street Theater. This month, Right to Survive, Breaking the Chains, will play Thursday, July 14th at 7 p.m. The night